Good morning, all, and welcome to our ECDC workshop on financing the future and rising sea level. We are this morning combining two working groups. You can envision it as where the dollars meet the sea. And as we know, and as we're going to hear, we need a lot of dollars in order to avoid meeting the sea in places where we really don't want it to be. This is one of the very important milestones, I think, in our efforts to figure out how we are, in fact, going to adapt to rising sea levels in the Bay. I suspect, because I cannot help myself, that I will have a number of things to say during the morning. But at this moment, I'm going to turn it over to Peggy to get us started.
Thank you, Chair. I'm going to take roll. Chair Wasserman?
Here.
Vice Chair Eisen?
Here.
Commissioner Ahn?
Here.
Commissioner Joya?
Here.
Commissioner Goring?
Here.
Commissioner Pine?
Here.
Commissioner Showalter?
Here.
Commissioner Lefkowitz?
Here.
Having a hard time today. Sorry, I've been up since 4:30. Did I miss anybody? Nope. It looks like you have seven commissioners here.
Thank you very
much. Sorry, eight.
All right. I thank you for those who are here in person and for those of you who are participating remotely. I know I urged everyone to participate in person, both for this and for our commission meeting this afternoon, just because we need for these important things to get together as much as possible. But I also appreciate there are distance and travel and environmental reasons that support participating remotely. So who's going to start? Dana. Take it away, please.
Great, thank you. So we will just jump right in. Our first agenda item is our financing the future agenda item, which is a presentation on our funding and investment framework that we have been working on with MTC ABAG. So I'll reintroduce myself. I'm Dana Breckwald. I'm the Assistant Planning Director for Climate Adaptation with BCDC. And I'm joined here today by Rachel Hardafelis, a resilience planner at MTC ABAG. And I also want to point out that Dave Botten, Assistant Director of Major Plans, is also here as well. So let me get my screen set up. There we go. So as I mentioned, we're here today to discuss the conclusion of our Sea Level Rise Adaptation Funding and Investment Framework. And this project builds off of major regional planning efforts, all of which have called for a priority action to fill knowledge gaps in the adaptation funding space. So as a result, we kicked off the framework here at the BARC Governing Board in December 2021, and we're back here today to conclude the project and summarize our final findings. So as we introduce the final findings of the framework, it's of course always important to put them in context. The Bay Area is defined by its relationship to water with iconic beaches on the outer coasts, waterfront parks across the region with cliffsides, wetlands, playgrounds, and more, vast wetlands and diverse habitats, and maritime culture and commerce. We also have diverse shoreline communities such as bustling downtowns, tight-knit residential neighborhoods, cozy beach towns, and industrial job centers, spanning across the Bay, the Delta, and the Outer Coast. And winding across the region, of course, are also transportation and infrastructure networks, which line the shoreline, both connecting us to one another, as well as supporting the region's economic vitality. But rising sea levels puts this all at risk. So today, we'll be spotlighting the framework findings on key financial estimates to tackle this challenge. But it's also important to keep in mind what's at stake with sea level rise adaptation and what adaptation could mean for the people and places that we care about so deeply. So I'm not going to go into a deep dive on climate change. So I'm sure you're all familiar with the numbers, but needless to say, sea level rise is happening already. The shoreline is already 8 inches higher than it was at the beginning of the 20th century. And coastal flooding is commonplace with king tides and extreme storms, as you've seen over this past winter. By 2050, we could be living with 12 to 32 inches of more of permanent water, with much, much more by the end of the century. Although there's still a lot of uncertainty at this point, but what we do know is that while this is a California-wide coastal issue, it will be felt most acutely here, with 2/3 of the statewide impacts occurring in the Bay Area. So clearly there's a need for significant adaptation action to occur in the region, or we lose much of what we love in the Bay Area. It's not possible to quantify every benefit of adapting our iconic shorelines and the diverse communities that live behind them, but we can spotlight some elements of what's at risk as waters rise. First, it's estimated that 200,000 jobs and 75,000 homes may be at risk, including over 12,000 of the vulnerable homes that are in the areas, the region's most socially vulnerable areas, as defined by BCDC's community vulnerability data. A regional perspective on this issue can ensure that everyone has the opportunity to adapt regardless of capacity level. And in addition, we have vulnerable acres at risk, including the region's rich, diverse wetlands and tidal marsh habitat. While $85 billion estimated is at risk in terms of the assessed value of parcels, our critical infrastructure will also be exposed. These estimates can be mitigated with coordination or multi-benefit solutions. Adapting vulnerable transportation networks with elevation or realignment could cost up to $150 billion. Other infrastructure, such as wastewater and public utilities, will also be extremely costly to adapt. Adapting to Rising Tides Bay Area, which BCDC released in 2020, painted a region-wide picture of the sea level rise risks, including areas where there's a nexus of critical regional systems all exposed to flooding at the same time. We call these hotspots, and they include areas where transportation infrastructure, vulnerable communities, and jobs and housing growth, or priority development areas, or priority conservation areas are all co-located, meaning that they pose a significant shared risk for the region, but they also represent opportunities where the shoreline adaptation could provide multiple benefits at once. Some of these areas are exposed early on, like San Rafael, Corte Madera, and Martinez, while others become exposed later on. So let's keep these hotspots in mind as we consider where investments may be prioritized in the future. I also want to emphasize here that while there will be a need for significant investment on the local level by cities, private landowners, and developers, local action will not be enough to meet the needs of sea level rise adaptation. Cities face tough trade-offs in adaptation, and most critical in the context of this project, without a region-wide approach, we risk competition between cities for funding only going to high-capacity cities, and we may actually miss adaptation in critical locations like the hotspots you just saw because we're not collectively agreeing on funding priorities. So just like cities can't solve sea level rise problems on their own, our regional agencies also need to coordinate to provide the most effective solutions. No single agency has all of the authorities and capacity to address adaptation solutions from all angles. Over the past several years, BCDC has been coordinating with MTC ABAG and the San Francisco Estuary Partner to align our respective regional plans and coordinate on implementation of the key tasks that we've identified. And this collaboration is the foundation for this project. BCDC's primary plan that informs our sea level rise work is our Bay Adapt Joint Platform, which was published in 2021. And the joint platform contains 9 actions and 21 tasks that overcome barriers and pave the way for faster, more equitable adaptation. It doesn't specify shoreline projects, but instead lays the foundation for more responsive engagement and community-led planning, consistent and accessible information, coordinated and aligned plans, projects that hit the ground with fewer snags and more funding, and a collective way to measure the region's progress. And I specifically want to call out Action 6 here, which is figure out how to fund adaptation. This project helped us to achieve the first task under this action, which is to expand understanding of the financial costs and revenues associated with regional adaptation, and help set the foundation for the next 2 tasks. And then lastly, I just want to remind this group that the joint platform is informed by guiding principles that we created with our stakeholders that you can see here. I won't read them at this time, But just keep in mind that these principles can help guide any future decisions that we as a region make about how we fill the region's funding gap, which you will hear about next. So at that, I'll turn it over to Rachel to introduce you to the project and its findings.
Thank you, Dana. Rachel Hardafilis, Resilience Planner at MDC ABAC. And just as a quick refresher on the framework, we'd like to review three of the key focus areas of this project. The first is to update and improve our regional accounting of anticipated sea level rise projects. And some of the outcomes of this are to update our prior regional analyses with local projects from recent planning efforts, as well as to estimate the regional sea level rise adaptation needs through 2050. We also have a focus to update and characterize the existing revenue sources for sea level rise adaptation. And to do this, we've inventoried and forecasted known revenues for state and federal public funding programs, and also characterized how some of these existing adaptation funds are dispersed and for what purpose. Finally, a focus area is to study how new revenues for sea level rise adaptation needs could be raised more equitably. And for this, we analyzed a range of possible revenue measures at different scales, trying to understand the high-level equity approaches to close the sea level rise funding gap. Next slide. In support of the first focus area, we've created a regional inventory of adaptation needs, identifying locally developed projects in various planning stages. This inventory was sourced by local plans and from BCDC's Shoreline Adaptation Project Mapping Program, or SAPMAP, which is an extension of EcoAtlas. This inventory was created to help us to develop high-level cost estimates for regional adaptation and to begin to identify planning and implementation gaps. We identified approximately 200 locally identified projects and study areas, which have less defined adaptation interventions, many of these with multiple sites among them. And to review this inventory in the fall, we spoke with local staff across all 9 Bay Area counties, updating over 2/3 of the inventory and adding additional projects as well. However, the data in this inventory was not complete in all cases. As you can see in this example, not all projects that are included in the inventory provide the same level of sea level rise protection, for example. Some less protective projects are shorter term projects, while others are green projects that provide other flood mitigation, but are not intended to harden the shoreline at the adaptation slash development edge. We were not able to gather flood protection information for approximately 50% of these projects. Similarly, projects were missing other details, such as 20% of the projects missing project costs. We developed methods to get around some of these data gaps, including the use of placeholders. Next slide. To better quantify the full magnitude of regional need, the inventory also needed a way to account for costs in areas with less advanced adaptation planning or project implementation, or in areas where the projects were missing cost information. To do this, placeholder values were created by assuming the protection of the shoreline in place, including areas that have no known plans, areas where a study has not yet defined specific projects, or areas where a project was not confirmed to provide sufficient protection. These placeholders should be thought of as project gaps that represent vulnerable segments of the shoreline and will be replaced by specific ideas generated from further local adaptation planning in the future. And while this is a helpful data summary of a moment in time, which we'll be making available as an online interactive map later this spring, in the long term, we envision BCDC's SAPMAP as the tool through which the region can continue to track adaptation projects. As such, data from the framework will be integrated into that effort, from which plans and project data can be updated as they develop. In the near term, we'll integrate this data into regional planning efforts, such as Plan Bay Area 2050 Plus and the Regional Shoreline Adaptation Plan. Next slide. Okay. And as mentioned previously, the inventory has been developed to help us estimate a regional cost estimate for shoreline adaptation. For context, the estimates that we'll discuss today are presented in year of expenditure. And the framework builds off of previous work done in Plan Bay Area 2050, which estimated the regional need at $19 billion through 2050. To update this information for the framework, we've made a number of assumptions. As a first step, we created updated cost assumptions for different project types using the best available data. With this change alone, the same set of projects from the previous work would be projected to be just shy of $40 billion. We also accounted for increased inflation over the last 3 years. Previous analysis looked at an inflation rate of 2.2% in the future, while the framework has assumed a rate of 3% through the study period. The framework also measures protection through 4.9 feet of sea level rise to account for both permanent sea level rise projected from the Ocean Protection Council through 2050, as well as a 100-year storm, which surpasses state guidance recommendations and also coincides with many of the local planning assumptions of some of the local efforts here in the region. Finally, where an area was identified with no current adaptation plans or clear concepts, the framework analysis assumed a default adaptation action for all vulnerable shorelines, including areas without planning and those in need of augmented plans. And when we piece these elements together, the adaptation estimate through 2050 is $110 billion, expressed in year of expenditure dollars. About half of that cost is based on locally identified projects, with the remainder estimated as a placeholder value, including estimates for additional sediment management needs. Partial project funding, where known, was also subtracted from this total, though there may be additional projects with partial funding that were not known at the time of the assessment. However, we'd like to emphasize that this is not necessarily the value that needs to be raised by governments to adapt. As a reminder, this estimate accounts for a very conservative approach in place, a very conservative approach in which we assumed the protection of the shoreline in place for all vulnerable shorelines, including low-density areas. This inventory is also a snapshot of a current moment in time, and adaptation efforts will continue to develop or shift, especially for projects that are in the early planning or conceptual stages. So the costs are likely to change as more information becomes available. Other strategies not estimated or assumed through the framework analysis will also play a role, including adaptation without protection, building code changes, or other local policy adjustments. In addition, future analysis will need to include riverine and groundwater data as it becomes regionally available, as well as additional adaptation plans, such as those made by utilities. So now that we've seen this total number, let's revisit that cost of inaction that we showed you on a previous slide. One key finding of this analysis is that even just a partial estimate of the cost of inaction was found to be much higher than the estimated cost of sea level rise adaptation projects through mid-century. Our cost of inaction analysis included losses to assessed property values of homes and the impacts of inaction on the transportation system, but did not include more sophisticated estimates such as real market value of property losses, impacts to the environment, communities, businesses, and more that would certainly increase this cost of inaction even further. The difference in these values makes it clear that adaptation action will be worthwhile many times over. So now that we've seen the total number for the region, let's dive into some additional details and a few of the distinctions across the counties. The analysis has shown that most of the planned projects are hybrid in nature, representing a regional focus on multiple benefits, such as levees paired with marsh restoration. So the threshold for the amount of nature-based solutions needed to be considered a hybrid project was very low, meaning that hybrid projects may be overrepresented here. In terms of the counties, Alameda and Marin counties have the highest cost estimates with the information that we've gathered, aligning with their anticipated sea level rise vulnerability. Notably, approximately half of the estimated value comes from placeholders created to develop cost estimates, with significant implementation gaps identified in Alameda, Contra Costa, and Marin counties. However, while identifying this implementation gap is helpful, it also does not point out a key nuance between these counties. For example, in Marin County, while they're still identifying specific projects for vulnerable locations, the county has almost no identified planning gaps. And in fact, the planning is quite robust and comprehensive. By contrast, in Contra Costa County, the placeholder value represented here represents a significant implementation and planning gap. We anticipate that these distinctions will become clear through future efforts, such as through the developing sea level rise planning guidelines in BCDC's regional shoreline adaptation plan and updating project information in Plan Bay Area 2050 and beyond. Let's piece these different elements together by taking a deep dive into one county. On the hotspots map, one major hotspot was identified in East Palo Alto. This location contains the Dunbarton Bridge touchdown, US 101, two socioeconomically vulnerable communities, the Ravenswood PDA, and the Bay Trail, as well as the Menlo Park and East Palo Alto Baylands Priority Conservation Area. When we look at the inventory, however, we see that not only has significant planning occurred along this shoreline, but several adaptation projects and study areas are already underway. This means that most of the countywide cost of the $11 billion that we have estimated is based on real costs, with a minority of those representing placeholders. We can even dive into one of these projects further and highlight the Safer Bay project, which consists of a series of levees, dikes, and restoration projects with a price estimate of over $200 million. Diving deeper into each county and looking at each shoreline's vulnerabilities, especially the areas of first and worst, i.e. early flooding and areas of interconnected vulnerabilities where key assets are located, as well as taking a deeper look at the planning and implementation gaps, can all help us to shape a more nuanced approach to layering the local funding with regional or state grants to meet each county's need. We've also developed an existing sea level rise adaptation revenue forecast to estimate how much revenue the region can anticipate through 2050 from sources that already exist. The framework has identified new public funding sources to add to prior revenue estimates in this space, such as the one in Plan Bay Area 2050, including 30 new adaptation grant programs from the past 2 years of state and federal funding. However, despite the influx of new revenue opportunities, only a small share of the billions of dollars in new state and federal funds are estimated to be available for both sea level rise adaptation and to be awarded in the Bay Area. What the Bay Area is likely to receive will be whittled down significantly when we assume a portion for statewide and national funds. Additionally, most of the 30 new funding line items are not specific to sea level rise adaptation, but may support a range of adaptation needs, such as wildfire or extreme heat. And so the revenue must be further filtered down to sea level rise specifically. When these limitations are accounted for, the region should expect only a fraction of new state and federal funding opportunities. Next slide. And I can pass it back over to Dana to close out this next section.
Thanks, Rachel. So it's in this context of funding that we look at exploring new funding sources. Part of the closing the gap will be increasing the available revenues. And while we can and will work to advocate for state and federal funding, it may also be beneficial to raise funds at the local, county, and regional scale to fund projects or provide matching funds to federal and state opportunities that emerge. The framework approached this analysis in a high-level exploratory way, intended to provide insight for future research and discussion in the years ahead, not to point to the right measure we need to take right now. And it's within this context that we researched three possible new revenue measures at the local, county, and regional scales to understand how much funding could be raised annually, what the bond issuance potential is, or how much different funding measures could raise for near-term project implementation, and initial equity implications, specifically who would pay versus who benefits. While many funding options are out there for sea level rise adaptation, such as sales taxes, business taxes, and development fees, among others, these options were filtered for overall feasibility and regional precedence, And the three measures that were selected based on these filters for generating case studies led us to focus on parcel taxes, ad valorem property taxes, and assessment districts. Of course, our high-level findings show that there is no silver bullet. There's no single revenue measure that's projected to be capable of addressing our funding gap. And as such, additional funding from state and federal sources will also be necessary. Of the three revenue types that we reviewed, parcel taxes and ad valorem property taxes were viewed at the county and regional scales, but we also looked at assessment districts on a sub-local basis. For each of these, we looked at high-level findings and used regional precedents to determine case studies. So parcel tax are typically a flat rate tax that don't account for the value or size of the property. An ad valorem property tax can be a progressive tax as higher assessed properties may pay more. However, we have limitations due to Prop 13. And lastly, assessment districts are directly tied to specific benefits with less opportunity to tailor them to account for equity disparities. As such, they're most feasible in specific areas with either more resources and or more direct impacts of sea level rise. For case studies, we did do regional estimates aside from the assessment districts. And with our consultants supporting us, we looked at example rates for what taxes could support if raised and bonded at different scales. We noticed that parcel taxes and ad valorem property taxes, the bonding potential is quite different. And this is due to the fact that ad valorem property taxes have a much higher tax rate for highly assessed parcels, as well as greater regional precedents. Again, just to remind you, this is an initial review of case studies, and it's exploratory to set the stage for future conversation and discussion. We also looked at all of these tools through the lens of equity, focused on who pays versus who benefits. For this analysis, we focused on ad valorem and property taxes, as they're more likely to be scaled at the county and regional levels as opposed to the assessment district, which is highly dependent on the community in question. So with regards to geographic equity, Santa Clara, Alameda, and San Francisco counties have the largest property tax rate, while San Mateo and Marin counties have a disproportionate share of the risk of sea level rise. However, the risks to parcel values obscure some additional nuances. For example, in the context of a regional revenue measure, the protection of key regional infrastructure such as US 101 in San Mateo and Marin would benefit travelers regionally, not just local residents. So our key finding here is that it will be necessary to use multiple funding sources such as ad valorem or taxes or parcel taxes to help balance the tax burden across the region. To look at social equity, we define socially vulnerable areas using BCDC's community vulnerability data, which categorizes areas using a number of vulnerability indicators, such as income and race. And with this information, we found that both taxes benefit socially vulnerable areas to a greater extent than the regional share, therefore advancing equity. However, parcel taxes were found to be less socially equitable than ad valorem property taxes. They place a higher tax burden on socially vulnerable areas. These are really high level findings. If a county or regional measure were to be considered for sea level rise adaptation, of course, we would need to take additional steps first, further research, creation of guiding principles to ensure that measures were specifically tailored to advance equitable outcomes from the perspective of who pays, as well as how the funds are ultimately structured and distributed. So as we conclude, we'd like to zoom out and review the key findings from this project. First is that the framework has identified a mix of green and gray projects, with more than half of the region's known projects focused on hybrid or multi-benefit solutions. These represent just one of the many ways to adapt our region to rising sea levels, but it also represents one potential cost range associated with adaptation. We've also identified a significant funding gap of over $100 billion. And to address this, increasing revenues, prioritizing or phasing shoreline protection, and discouraging development in highly vulnerable areas should all be considered moving forward. We've also identified key differences across the region with disparity, both in terms of estimated sea level rise costs, as well as the level of local planning and implementation due to resource constraints. And we've determined that multiple funding sources at multiple scales will be determined to required to address the funding gap even with prioritizing and phasing of adaptation projects. Again, it's crucial to prioritize equity. And in addition to considering funding approaches that reduce the burden on socially vulnerable areas, we can also utilize shared principles to ensure that our adaptation decisions are made with equity in the forefront. And lastly, all these pieces together make it clear that a regional approach will be a critical piece of the funding and financing puzzle to ensure that we meet regional goals and avoid leaving critical pieces of the adaptation puzzle behind. So I do want to point out, as we saw in San Mateo County, there's already significant work planned or underway. So we have started to take a bite from this $110 billion bill. Just three examples here. Foster City is in the final year of construction for its levee improvement program, which will protect the 30,000 residents of this waterfront community from sea level rise, storms, and high tides. The SR-37 corridor adaptation is currently in planning stages, and this east-west route is critical for the connection of the region, connecting the North Bay counties. And equity is also a key consideration in this project. Unlike many other regional corridors, the majority of surveyed drivers on the route are lower income, with many in the North Bay using the corridor to connect to jobs in Marin and beyond. Moving to the East Bay, the North Richmond Shoreline Living Levee Project seeks to provide protection for both key regional infrastructure, including the West County Wastewater District Wastewater Treatment Plant, as well as frontline disadvantaged communities near the shoreline. These and our example in San Mateo County are just a handful of the examples that we could share with you. There are many more exciting efforts already happening in communities large and small, but every step forward is making a difference in the diverse communities and networks across the Bay Area, and we can build on these experiences and learn as we continue to plan for the region's adaptation. So as the framework project concludes, we've identified a number of actions to move these findings forward. First, to prioritize sea level rise investments in upcoming plans, such as MTC ABAG's Plan Bay Area 2050 Plus and BCC Shoreline Adaptation Plan, to help identify which projects might require early action and which areas might be appropriate for lower cost interventions. Second, MTC ABAG will explore how to integrate resilience into envisioned regional measures on affordable housing and transportation to the extent possible. Third, BCDC will complete and maintain the development of the shoreline adaptation project mapping data to ensure that the region has access to the best possible inventory. In light of our initial analysis on the limitations of new revenue measures, it will be critical to continue to use state and federal resources to address our funding gap. So we should continue to engage and mobilize elected officials to accelerate our state and federal advocacy to secure a greater portion of funding for the Bay Area. And our last two next steps are to fulfill tasks 6.2 and 6.3 in the joint platform. And this is to better define lead roles for funding plans and projects to ensure that the region is empowered to secure adaptation monies and distribute them equitably. And lastly, to identify a path to support cities, counties, and the private sector to fill the funding gaps that the region cannot fill alone. So at that, we'll thank you for your time and attention and turn it back to Chair Wasserman to facilitate questions and discussion.
Thank you very much, Dana. The questions on the screen are illustrative. They are not limiting. So I will start with entertaining questions or comments from commissioners. Start up here, honor your attending. Rebecca, go ahead.
I have a number of questions. And I think I heard a very similar, if not identical, presentation at the BART meeting, and I still have questions. I thought I saw on one of your slides that we estimate $125,000 a foot to adapt roads to sea level rise. It was in a footnote in one of the earlier slides. Are we saying that it costs $1 million for every 8 feet of roads to adapt them to sea level rise?
That's a very good question, and it is an extremely high-level assumption that we've made looking at the elevation or realignment of transportation, and that is a median cost estimate for that specific type of adaptation. So it is one of the higher cost estimates for transportation, absolutely.
So of that $110 billion that we came to at the end of the day, is a lot of that this transportation piece of it?
I believe about somewhere over 50%, I think, of the estimate.
Oh, really?
When it comes down to it, just due to the nature of how much it costs to work in infrastructure, especially in the context of the Bay, where so much of our infrastructure is in highly dense areas, which makes that cost much, much higher.
Yeah. I see that we've made that adjustment from 2 feet to 4.9 feet on sea level rise. Is the cost to adapt to sea level rise directly correlated to the level of sea level? In other words, is it cost twice as much to adapt to 4 feet as it does to 2 feet, or is it not linear in that way?
I don't believe that it's linear, and our specific analysis wouldn't have shown that relationship even if that was the case, because we also took a more conservative approach to what was protected. So our analysis assumed that everything was protected, which in some cases not protecting or using managed retreat or alternative strategies might be a different cost estimate, and in some cases less. So in addition to that protect in place assumption and that escalated inundation level, yes, those two things make it a much higher cost. But in terms of whether it's linear, don't believe we'd be able to say.
I guess what I'm trying to understand is if you're talking about 2 feet of sea level rise, are you going to need, I don't know, 70% of that $110 billion just at 2 feet and the other 30%, you know, for the remaining 2.9 feet? Or do you have to, in other words, is the $110 billion, which is a pretty scary number, is it something that we can expect to see, you know, sooner rather than later, or it'll just, you know, over the course of time and sea level rise, it'll just keep adding up, if you understand.
Yes. So I think that's related to, you know, what gets wet then and when we're constructing different projects ultimately. And in the course of this framework, the assumptions that we made, we didn't have a lot of construction year for different projects, and so we had to make a lot of assumptions. But through Plan Bay Area 2050 Plus and I believe the Regional Shoreline Adaptation Plan, both of those efforts will be able to explore this further. And I can speak to, especially with Plan Bay Area 2050 Plus, we plan to look at what gets wet at each layer and hopefully start to think about what the difference is when we look at prioritizing in that sense in terms of cost. Mm-hmm. So we should have answers building on this work, hopefully in those future efforts.
Okay. I have two more questions, although they may be a little dense. One of your slides, and I tried to find slide numbers on the bottom right-hand corner, and sometimes I could and sometimes I couldn't. So I think it's somewhere around slide 15. It was called Adaptation Needs Additional.
16.
Is it 16? And where you explain sort of the green, hybrid, and gray projects. And I just need a little more understanding of that. Many, many people probably understand that very well, including people to the right and left of me, but I don't. So can you just, as you know, sort of teach me about the green, gray, hybrid distinctions and what that tells us?
Sure, and I can start and see if anyone would like to add. So gray would be protection elements such as seawalls or traditional levees, as we would consider them. And green, I think, on the other extreme would be marsh restoration, for example, or other types of infrastructure, and so, or adaptations. And hybrid would be somewhere in between or a combination of those elements. Ecotone levee could be considered hybrid, or just marsh restoration next to a seawall in one project could also be considered hybrid. Mm-hmm. And the threshold for whether different project leads or jurisdictions considered something as a hybrid project could be quite low in some cases or really different in some cases. So there's a little ambiguity in terms of the firm lines of what hybrid could mean, but it really, the green and the gray are more defined different adaptation types.
I mean, in the ideal world, would they all be green?
Ideally, but due to the type of development that we have, especially so close to the shoreline, in some cases that won't protect because we don't have the space for it, or the type of development that is in that location is not suitable for it. For example, right. It wouldn't make sense to have marsh restoration on the Embarcadero shoreline.
Sure.
And so just due to the nature in which we have developed, there are hybrid accommodations that ultimately need to be made if we want protection.
Okay. And then maybe this is for Dana, because you were talking about the taxes and the possibilities of raising revenue through taxes. So I don't know enough about this, but if we are going to try to find funding on a regional basis so that once we have the monies, we can allocate them to where the need is without regard to how wealthy or not wealthy that community is. Are these taxes that we could even be collected on a regional basis and distributed regionally, or are they collected by necessity from counties or cities, and therefore they would probably be used by that county or city?
I can.
Yeah, I'm okay. So MTC has the history of doing these types of measures at a regional scale. So I will let Rachel respond to that one.
Rachel.
So with the three different case studies that we looked at, the parcel taxes and ad valorem property taxes are tax types that could be raised at the regional scale potentially, or the county scale. So there's variation in terms of the scale that is available to them. We also looked at assessment districts as a case study. And these are, well, theoretically, they could be applied at a very high scale, such as the region. There are almost no examples of that. They are typically used at the sub-local level. And that's what we looked at when we were making assumptions about it in the case study. Mm-hmm.
So let's take ad valorem taxes as an example. So Alameda County would assess the tax and Marin County would assess the tax, but what are the chances then that the monies that are raised in that way could be used to help Napa or wherever the need is? You see what I'm saying?
Go ahead.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. As I say, I knew people to the left and right.
Sure. I mean, just to point out with the San Francisco Bay Restoration Authority, that was created by state statute that allows the monies to be collected regionally. But the statute also provides an allocation mechanism. So
different counties.
Yeah, 50% goes to based on population and 50% goes to highest needs. So, but this is all reflected by state legislation.
Okay, so there's a mechanism.
Right.
Great, that's where I was going. Thank you so much, everyone.
Commissioner Gioia.
Thanks.
Oh, no, I'm sorry.
First, thanks for the presentation.
And John, wait, I apologize. Sure. I'm gonna recognize the people who are here first. Commissioner Showalter.
Okay, I have two questions. One is just very local. It's a little hard to read those maps at that, the scale they are. So when I saw the placeholder area for the South Bay, what jurisdictions does that represent? Is that Moffitt, Sunnyvale, or does that include Mountain View?
I will say that we are going to be publishing our online map later this in the spring that will allow you to zoom in to those project and placeholder locations. If you want to answer specifically about that location, but later on you will have access to the map that will allow you to zoom in on, in greater detail.
And I'll just add that I can't speak to that area at this moment, but can certainly look into that for you.
Thank you.
Okay. And you said the Moffitt Sunnyvale.
Is it Moffitt Sunnyvale or Mountain View? I'm spending a lot of time at City Mountain Council meetings talking about financing our sea level rise protections, and I just want to make sure that they're properly reflected here. Anyway, so my second question is about the calculations you did. I'm assuming that you just said that the existing law we have for Proposition 13 is what you did the calculation for. You didn't do the calculation for if we had a split role or, you know, even a more significant change in Proposition 13. It was just the existing one. Is that correct?
That is correct. We based our case studies on existing, on precedents. And so there are other options beyond what this initial study looked at, but for this initial high-level assessment, we only looked at precedents.
Okay. I would certainly be interested in what, you know, the proposed changes that haven't passed would garner that we might be able to use for this. Thank you.
So,
Commissioner Pine.
Yes, thank you. So I was a little surprised by your forecast that existing public revenues would only be $5.5 billion over the period. Like when we look at what the kind of investments that the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is making in other regions of the country, you know, can't we expect more than $5.5 billion?
That's a great question. And again, what we looked at is what the region has historically received in terms of its portion of funding. And we use those values to project forwards through 2050. And so it is possible that in the future we might receive a larger portion. But I think that one thing that we've learned through this analysis is that the region likely needs to advocate for a larger portion than it has historically received. To balance what we're receiving vis-a-vis the rest of the country.
Can I also help answer that question? And I see Warner in the audience, and Warner and I have talked about this a number of times. There is something starting with a capital H that Florida, New York, and Texas have been involved with or have received that we haven't. It's called a hurricane. And so those monies have been, for the most part, after-the-fact monies. And so it's a really interesting situation because I think what we as staff are suggesting is that the advocacy that needs to be done has to be done in preparation for, as opposed to as a recovery from.
Because I mean, I think the challenge here is, you know, it's not foreseeable to me that we can raise $110 billion through local tax measures. That there's going to need, there has to be substantial federal and state support.
Just to jump in on that one, absolutely. And this largely leaves out in dollar estimates what private developers will provide. Some of the gap will have to be provided by private developers as they build projects that they need to protect, and their contributions, depending on the project and the location and a bunch of other things, may well extend beyond their own project. But those numbers are very hard to project at this regional level. Commissioner Gioia.
Thanks. I do think we need to take the estimates as a range, right? I mean, we know that these are all estimates, and whatever it is, it's a lot of money. And I think getting back to David Pine's point, we're going to have to look at all these different funding opportunities, federal, state, and local. And just reflecting, I've been elected in local government for 35 years, 25 of those with the county, and have been involved with regional measures, with Dave on the Restoration Authority, AA, with county measures, with sub-county measures. And I think we need to be pursuing sort of multiple pathways. One at a regional level makes a lot of sense, but also I think there's going to be a lot of effort at county levels. So I sort of see a parallel path of, I mean, a lot of my work's thinking about how do we communicate our needs so the public will vote on it? We can have the best policy in the world and the best need, but unless we can communicate that need in a politically successful way, we're not going to get voters to pass it. Equity needs to be really at the foundation, both from standpoint of our communities, our highly impacted communities, regional equity as well. So I think all the work going forward sort of needs to lay out information that we could use from a regional standpoint for a regional measure and a county by county standpoint. So your estimates of what the cost will be by county is really important. We're starting a planning process that's going to be more robust in Contra Costa. A lot of work we have cut out for us, as your own chart shows. Voters in counties are not going to pay. It's going to be harder to get them to pay for something that's occurring somewhere else. We went through this discussion. You know, I thought we were very successful in how we designed Measure AA with, as Dave says, part of it was based on need, part based on population. People want to see a return to source. So I think our effort should also support the sub-regional efforts that will go on around the Bay Area by county. And we need leadership in every one of the 9 counties to make this work. And we also need some regional leadership as well. So that's sort of my message, is pursue 2 tracks, have information that's helpful for those of us doing countywide planning processes, as well as, and leave it up to those counties to figure what is going to have the best chance of passage. But at the same time, look at a regional measure as well that has a pretty broad stakeholder involvement.
Thank you, John. Commissioner Gorin.
Good morning, everyone. And I agree with everything that John just said. I have a couple of questions. Speaking to question number one, how do we get the attention of elected leaders? And certainly we have many on BCDC. But can you give us a status report of the local task force that you are convening and how you might involve them in that question and this larger context?
I can answer that. And then Commissioner Joya is actually the chair of that task force, so I'll make space for him if he'd like to respond as well. So we had our initial kickoff meeting on January 24th. I've been trying to bring on a consultant to help facilitate that particular group. That contracting has been taking a while, so our second meeting has been pushed off a bit, but we are anticipating that will get going again in the next month or two. And then I think we have some slides that demonstrate this in our next, the Rising Sea Level Working Group meeting, but there is a reciprocal relationship, obviously, between the task force and this group, as evidenced by the fact that Chair Joya is here for both. So I think this is the type of space where we can identify what type of issues we'd like to bring to that task force and how we'd like to get them in alignment with what we're working on in this working group. Yeah. So I don't know if you have anything additional to say.
I mean, I think it is important to use that regional electeds work group to identify the leaders in counties who are willing to step up. I know they're getting informed and educated more on the issue from BCDC staff, but they're also expressing, you know, where they need and want more information. And I think that is a good starting point. We'll need more countywide leaders, but I think that we can get, that's a good starting point to develop some leadership around the Bay Area. We need to do more of that.
Thanks, John, for chairing that group. I think it might be helpful if the BCDC commissioners are sort of kept abreast of what information is being presented to the local task force and what they're thinking and considering, maybe providing opportunities for them to join us in some joint discussions, especially regarding financing for the infrastructure around the Bay. Obviously, I can check in with the 2 folks from Sonoma County, but I think it might be good to keep that on our radar. And then one final question, and I know that Dave Pine and John both join me in representing the San Francisco Bay Restoration Authority and opined about how financing has been used to, I think, benefit the whole Bay Area. And I'm wondering if we have a category in this report, or maybe in addition to this report, the pie graphs showing what is being funded, what is being created and financed and completed throughout the Bay Area. So you have some pie graphs about maybe the dollars necessary and the strategies necessary, but what has already been completed to work towards those goals?
I can speak to some of this and then pass it off if there's additional notes. But we only have a partial assessment of what has been completed thus far. Some of that was just what we uncovered from the support of local jurisdictions. And we also have a subset of projects we identified as completed through the SAP map, which was a helpful resource for us as well. And so I would say we have a partial sense of what has been done, but not a very comprehensive one at this time.
And I would just end my comments by saying the Restoration Authority is getting ready to release a five-year plan, sort of a report card of what we've accomplished over the past 5 years. And it might be a good appendix for this report. And I'm still thinking about ways to integrate the information about the projects under in design as well as in completion. So thank you so much.
Thank you, Commissioner Lefkowitz.
Thank you, and thank you, staff, for a wonderful report, or very comprehensive and well done. I have a couple of high-level questions. Frankly, you know, the report filled me with a little bit of dismay, and I thought maybe breaking down some high-level things might give us a little bit of hope. I was just curious if, you know, heuristically or off the top of your heads, you had any idea of how much of that $110 billion number might be private property projects versus public infrastructure, public projects? Any directional notion at all?
I don't think that we have that information, or at least not a good sense of how the proportion of that information. There's a few private projects that we're aware of, certain developments like Treasure Island, for example, but they are few, and I would say the majority are either public, and then also a large portion, as we mentioned earlier, about 50% of that estimate is placeholder cost estimates, and so those are certainly unknown.
Of course. All right. And my next question was just about the timing of priorities. Do we, you know, does it, would it make any sense to try to prioritize certain, say, marsh and levee projects that might buy us time or give further support to other projects that are further inland? Is there some benefit to thinking about phasing remediations? So, you know, we're not thinking about coming up with this money all in a 10-year period.
Yeah, that's even though we didn't get into in this project exactly what that criteria would be for prioritizing and phasing, that is one of our key takeaways, is that we won't be able to do all this at once. And there are areas that, as you pointed out, for example, restoration projects need to occur first. There are certain locations along the shoreline that are flooding already today. So there are a number of criteria that we could use for a prioritization moving forward. We just haven't gotten to a point in this project where we've made any decisions about what that might look like and what tools we would use to implement that prioritization.
Fair enough. Thank you. And just one more question. I just wonder, this is such a nice piece of context setting. Looking at the larger, even California, have you anecdotally or otherwise heard any estimates from other high impact areas that, is LA, Orange County, San Diego, are they going through this process? Are they also going to be calling on state and federal resources? how do we think about, you know, how unique we are on this timeline?
Good question. And I am not aware of any other places in California that have done this kind of assessment in terms of what the costs would be. I know there's been some locations, for example, I believe San Mateo County has an assessment of what is at risk. But in terms of what those costs are, I believe that we might be the only ones that I know of that have done such an assessment. And I think that just speaks to the unique vulnerability that we have here. We are susceptible to most of the sea level rise inundation. And just the amount of shoreline that we have here in the Bay makes us very unique in terms of the geography of the rest of the state.
Thank you so much.
Just to reemphasize the answer to the last question, I would remind you that 1/3 of the California coastline is within the Bay, and the estimate is that 2/3 of the damage from rising sea level to the state of California will occur inside San Francisco Bay. Commissioner Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to start by congratulating the staff on attacking with great vigor and thought a very, very difficult question. I really see that you guys are devising a method and an approach for organizing us for thinking about this problem. This is, I think, the second time that I've seen this kind of presentation. It's greatly improved. It's becoming more robust, and I hope that that will continue. My first question is, do you guys see that we have the resources and the regional support to continue to refine and update our inventory and our map?
Very good question. I would say that right now, since these are some of the first assessments that have been done, we did it in Plan Bay Area 2050 a few years ago, and we built on that through the framework effort. And to make this a more robust analysis in the future, I would say we would need more resources. As of right now, it's a very small team that does this, and there's not really a structure for accounting for the different adaptation measures that are going on around the Bay at this time. So it is a lengthy effort just to figure out what is being planned where and what's going on. So I would say more resources would be needed, yes.
Okay. And I'll just jump in and say that our SAPMAP program, which is led by Todd Hollenbeck over here, is an ongoing program. We do have resources devoted to him and his staff. And also, if we have the time to get to it, we'll be talking about our regional shoreline adaptation plan again, which we've been looking at ways in which we can have sort of a continual stream of information between cities and counties and the planning and the projects that they are working on, and incorporating that into our regional approaches and our regional tracking. So we certainly have plans to continue this back and forth of information so that we have more data over time. But as Rachel mentioned, we're working on very few staff and always seeking ways to support and expand these types of programs.
Okay, I think that the effectiveness of this work will be greatly enhanced if we can make sure to be able to continue it and have you all be the repository of what's going on, so that we have one place that we can look. And I would ask you to not be bashful about including supporting that ongoing effort as a recommendation from your work. I was very happy to see you framing this as a return on investment. I am sure, frankly, that the costs are going to be higher than we think they are now, but I also think the benefits will be greater. And I would encourage you to think about, you mentioned that this your benefit number was just a first cut. And if we can get that in a little more with a little more sophisticated approach, that should help us in our communication effort about the value of this. Does your work include the cost of rising groundwater?
At this time, it does not, because we did not have robust groundwater information for the entire jurisdiction, just a subset at this time.
I understand that, but there's just one example of the, how things are going to cost more. Did you think about framing your cost numbers through in the context of operational landscape units? We have seen a lot of information indicating that both understanding our vulnerability and understanding our adaptation options is can be well framed by thinking about these operational landscape units. Is it easy for you to look at cost in that way as well?
Actually, yes, it is. That is a layer that we have overlapped with the geographies that we identified. And so that is another way that we can cut those numbers.
Great. Do you guys consider that the way we have reached out to the public, the way we have funded work preparing for earthquakes, is a frame in which we might be able to approach the funding for sea level rise and storm surge impacts?
I can jump in on this one, because I actually used to work in the earthquake space, so I'm pretty familiar with that. The way that that's generally been approached is at a jurisdiction by jurisdiction level or at a state level through legislation. So we don't have any regional precedents for funding earthquake retrofits at a regional level. We can certainly learn from lessons, you know, through that space as to what has worked and what hasn't. And I think we should pull on multiple fields and arenas, such as the restoration space, which has been quite successful in generating funding for projects. So it is an example, but it still has the challenge of, you know, raising funding on a city by city basis through grants from FEMA or, you know, entities like that, or occurring at a statewide level where the resources get distributed throughout the state. For example, in earthquakes, LA was always a major competitor for funds, and LA gets much more of the funds for earthquake retrofit than the Bay Area does. Similar problem that we might have about not getting our fair share of resources here for adaptation.
But we did have regional, do I remember correctly, we have regional taxes that have been supporting, as I understand it, tens of billions of dollars of retrofit to bridges and roads and maybe coordinated by Caltrans, but the public has supported this work and has seen the benefit. Am I correct about that?
I'll pass it over to Dave.
Hi, good morning, everyone. Yes, most
Dave,
certainly.
Dave, just state your name for the record.
Oh, yes, apologies. Dave Vaughton with MTC ABAC. Yes, that's absolutely true. Regional measures 1 and 2 did focus on seismic enhancements for Bay Area bridges. So that is an example of regional action in the seismic resilience space. But I think, you know, as Dana correctly pointed out, you know, in general, those earthquake actions have occurred at other levels of government. So I think the question with sea level rise is really, what is the right balance between local, regional, state, and federal investment in this space? And it'll probably require some element from all of those different levels of government.
Thank you. And lastly, just to Dana, so if there are, is there information from this report that you think is particularly of importance to our working group on sediment and beneficial reuse? I hope you will make sure to get that information to Brenda so that the commissioners working in that working group can bring this information in to our deliberations.
Yes, absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you. Commissioner Moulton Peters.
Thank you. I want to thank you for the presentation and appreciate all the staff work and this working group to begin to get our arms around a really large topic. Question and a comment. Did the cost estimate include relocation of utilities, preservation or modification or reconstruction of infrastructure of any sort?
It did not include relocation at this time.
Okay. And then just a comment building on the need for partnership with local government that most of the commissioners, county commissioners have expressed, is that it's great to have BCDC be the aggregator and the set guiding principles and priorities. And in the way that MTC does, I also think it's important to find ways to empower the local counties to do their part in this planning and to fund their work as well. So I just wanted to add that. Thank you.
Thank you. Commissioner Gioia.
Yeah, one thing I forgot to say is I don't think we should be taking the stormwater fee or tax off the plate, because that is becoming a major issue. Folks who are with the Regional Water Quality Control Board know all the new permit requirements on development and permits on cities and counties has come with a very increased cost. And those stormwater fees are not exempt under Prop 218 like water and wastewater fees were. So you have to go to the ballot every time you want to raise those fees. So we're seeing local clean water agencies, cities and counties having greater responsibility in this area, and it's related to sea level rise. So I really would argue to not take that off the plate. And whether it's done regionally or done county by county, there's been some efforts county by county to look at this. And we can look at how we support it regionally. So I just want to point that off. I don't know how we can remove off the plate something that which there's a growing mandate and responsibility to do.
I think that concludes commissioner comments. Peggy, are there any buddy in the audience who wants to speak? I would note that we have a second presentation that is related to this, but focusing on the broader sea level rise issue, as I said at the beginning. I see no hands in the house. Peggy, remote public speakers.
Yeah.
That was not a discouragement, guys.
We do have one person, Jennifer Chang Hatterley. Go ahead, unmute yourself. You have 3 minutes for public comment. Go ahead.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Jennifer Hederle, and I'm speaking today on behalf of the Sierra Club's Bay Alive campaign, which advocates for preserving and enhancing bay ecosystems as a necessary resource for ensuring community resilience in the face of sea level rise. We're pleased to see this joint effort to better understand the magnitude of the challenge before us and to plan ahead for funding regional sea level rise adaptation. However, we'd like to see much more clarity and specific attention paid to the investments needed to adapt our natural ecosystems. For example, how are the costs of inaction assessed for these natural assets? Where green strategies are tallied, does it predominantly reflect existing local planning and projects, or do placeholder projects consider everywhere that strong opportunities exist for such strategies? The health of our bay communities depends not only on resilience for the built environment and our transportation infrastructure, we also need a healthy bay to help sustain our communities. Bay ecosystems provide great value in stormwater retention, carbon sequestration, and biodiversity, which research shows is at critical risk as several species are collapsing. This affects us all, and these natural resources need to be valued and protected as the vital assets they are. Too often, threats to ecological assets get ignored in cost-benefit analyses and play only a minor role in adaptation planning. But as climate change worsens, we can no longer afford to take them for granted. Ecosystem valuations, which assign a value to the ecosystem or the service it provides, such as water filtration or wave attenuation, are evolving to provide a more sophisticated and acceptable way to assess the benefits the environment brings to an area. An example is ART Bay Area's work with the Natural Capital Project. We urge you to strengthen the framework with robust attention to resilience for our natural assets, including ecological costs of inaction and consideration of much needed upland migration pathways as sea level rises. Thank you very much for the opportunity to comment.
Thank you, Jennifer. We have no more public comment, Chair.
We have one in the audience, Warner. Identify yourself for those very few who may not know.
Commissioners. My name is Warner Chabot. I'm the executive director of the San Francisco Estuary Institute. SFEI has served local, regional, and state agencies on landscape scale environmental issues for 3 decades. We provide science support, data, and GIS tools to support, to help monitor, measure, and visualize climate adaptation challenges and possible solutions. We don't do policy advocacy. This is really a policy issue you're dealing with. Therefore, my remarks are my own as a somewhat biased observer. The $110 billion challenge is the most consequential public policy issue this region has faced in the last 60 years since the beginning origin of BCDC. As elected and policy leaders, it may be your most difficult challenge over the next decade. The Bay Area faces many climate challenges, including drought, wildfire, and extreme heat. However, the most significant defining issue of our region is the triple threat of sea level rise, rising groundwater, and lowland flooding from more extreme and frequent storms. That's because our this triple whammy is also the most significant climate equity issue that we face. That's because our low-income, underserved, and disadvantaged communities are the most likely to be hit the hardest by rising seas, rising groundwater, and flooding. As policy leaders, you need to prioritize regional priorities. Obviously, influential voices will call for regional billion-dollar housing and transportation measures. However, if we don't address and solve the triple threat, those housing and transportation solutions will soon be underwater. This shoreline issue is core to solving many of those issues. While the solution requires good science and innovative engineering, this region has those resources in abundance. We have thousands of engineers, scientists, and planner types working on this issue. However, two areas that may need the most significant vision and innovation are governance and municipal finance. To be crude and blunt, this is where you as elected regional policy leaders have an extraordinarily large and extremely hot potato in your lap. Any funding solution is going to involve local, state, and federal actions. I have one local and one federal action for you to consider. At a local level, please note that we made great progress 8 years ago when we passed Measure AA. We raised $25 million a year for wetlands restoration. At the same time we made that measure, Los Angeles passed Measure W. They are now raising $300 million a year, 12 to 14 times as much in perpetuity. So it can be done. Local elected bond measures that address local issues are possible at a much greater possibility than Measure AA. Number two, the Army Corps. New York, Louisiana, and Texas are running circles around us in raising, each of them have a $30 to $50 billion proposal in the pipeline to deal with shoreline adaptation. I'm not suggesting they're concrete heavy solutions, but I am suggesting that here in the Bay Area, we have innovative leaders that are moving the Army Corps into thinking about working with nature, and we have the possibility of the Bay Area being a national leader and how an urban region tackles these types of issues with vision and hope and clarity. And I think we should be thinking about a project process with the Army Corps of Engineers to try to work with them on a $30 to $50 billion big, hairy, audacious goal for the Bay Area to tackle this issue, because we can also focus on the low-hanging fruit of nature-based solutions, such as restoring our wetlands. And those are the areas that will also help protect the disadvantaged, underserved communities that are going to be hit the hardest. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to make a suggestion and a couple of comments. I'm going to make a suggestion first, just to be clear. The program this morning was supposed to now move to a report on rising sea level and Bay Adapt and how we move forward on that in the context of what we just heard. That discussion itself has a number of important layers that I don't think we can effectively address in the next 12 minutes. We're going to reschedule that meeting for next month. I think we need to think about it a little bit, but we will probably do it again as a joint workshop, because obviously the financial needs and the financial availability of funds are a critical part of doing anything. Couple of comments. And I will make a few more specific comments when we summarize this for the commission meeting in an hour. I certainly want to join in the chorus of thanking staff for the very hard work on this, both agencies, and thank the staff of both agencies for the cooperation. Certainly, there's been a number of areas of cooperation between BCDC and MTC. Over the years, and particularly over the last couple of years, and particularly in this area. But I think this effort represents a significant step forward, which is going to be absolutely critical to continue and indeed accelerate if we're going to have success in saving our natural resources, our built resources, and our people from the threats that are coming. I would refer you back to slide 15. This story is a story of real threat and real hope. And we need both. And that slide is the one that compares $230 billion plus of potential damage. And we know that's low. To the $110 billion cost of what we can conceive of now in terms of what we need to do to mitigate that cost. It's not going to eliminate it. We cannot delude ourselves, but it can make a very significant dent if we figure out how to raise and effectively spend that money now. And some of that, as this presentation has talked about, is going on now. This is not all conjectural for the future. There are a bunch of things we don't know, as has been pointed by questions and candid and transparent answers, which are important. And I will go back to John Gioia's comment that I think is absolutely critical. We need to continue figuring out how to marshal this information and get it out to the broader constituency of elected officials, but even more importantly, to the broader constituency of the public, who are going to have to support in a variety of ways, not only regional and local bond measures, but also our efforts to affect state and federal resources to devote more resources to our region, to the Bay Area, if we're going to succeed in protecting ourselves. So I thank you. This is an iterative process. We've said that from the beginning. I will continue to say it. What we are doing builds step by step and builds by bringing in plans and looking at the plans from a variety of perspectives and circumstances and locations. And we're just going to have to keep at it. And yes, Mr. Gunther, we need more resources. Unless there are any other comments or questions, I think that brings us to adjournment of this session. I look forward to seeing most of you at 1 o'clock for the commission meeting. Thank you very much for being here. Thank you for participating remotely.